feeling herself again, or nearly herself. She straightened up and approached the counter, giving him his smile back even as the two women who'd followed her in browsed among the jars and their mysterious contents. What she said then was contained in a single word, a word she hadn't had to memorize. Morfina.
Welcome to Book Tour. I'm Lynn Neary. T.C. Boyle is a prolific writer with energy to burn. Winner of the Pen Faulkner Award for World's End and National Book Award finalist for Drop City, Boyle is the author of 12 novels, three of them based on historical figures. In The Road to Wellville, he explores the life of the man who had a major influence on the food we eat, John Harvey Kellogg. In The Inner Circle, he cast his writer's eye on the man who changed our sex lives, Alfred Kinsey. His newest book, The Women, is the story of architect Frank Lloyd Wright, as told from the perspective of his wives and mistresses. These beautiful, troubled, hilarious, tough-willed women, as one reviewer described them, are the real heroines of this novel, based on the life of a man who changed the way we think about design. Boyle read from The Women at the Politics and Prose Bookstore on February 12, 2009.
So I'm here to tell you a little bit about my new book, The Women, and then to take some questions and sign your books. Some of you may know that I've written about two other of the great egomaniacs of the 20th century. John Harvey Kellogg of The Road to Wellville, who, of course, invented the cornflake, and most recently, Alfred C. Kinsey of The Inner Circle, who, of course, invented sex. And now we have Frank Lloyd Wright. And I had been brooding about writing about Frank Lloyd Wright for the last 16 years because I live in his first California house. And I'm lucky in that whenever I want to discover something, I write a book about it. So I can go where I want and do what I want. I did develop a greater appreciation for the house by writing this book and finding out about Frank Lloyd Wright. And how it came about that I lived there is largely because of my wife. I made my escape from L.A. You know, I moved to L.A. because USC gave me a job, which I still have and I still enjoy. But, you know, I got tired of having to fight traffic every time I wanted to get a jar of peanut butter. And I wanted to live in a quieter place. So I decided to move to Santa Barbara. It's 100 miles away. It's still within striking distance. And we looked around. We couldn't find any houses. And at about that time, The Road to Wellville came out. And I had to go to New York to do a reading in the park with Patti Smith and to go on some TV show. So they put us at the Stanhope, which is by Central Park and is just across from Metropolitan Museum. So my wife, and I like to call her Frau Boyle because when she goes with me to Germany, that's who she is. So Frau Boyle was extremely bored, and she went to the Metropolitan Museum where, as many of you will know, they have a Frank Lloyd Wright room. They have the living room from the Francis Little house right in there. She spent 3 days there, and voila, a week later, she found this house, and we moved in. And incidentally, it is 100 miles to get to USC. I go once a week, but not this week. If you've been driving on the freeways of L.A., yes, I am that guy in the red car coming up on you at 85 with my lights on. I'm sorry. I will say, though, I have learned that in D.C. you have a law against driving while talking on the cell phone. Is that correct?
Yes.
God bless you. We finally got that law in place last year. And the fine is something like $100 for a first offense. I think it should be $10,000 for a first offense, execution for the second. Yeah, okay. So I thought I would give you a little taste of the book. I've written this from the point of view of Frank Lloyd Wright's women. I wanted to find a kind of more elegant design for this book, maybe one that would please the master himself. And so I've told it from the point of view of each of his principal three women, his two wives and his mistress, and with some input from his first wife, Kitty. You may know that my house, for instance, is a prairie-style house. It's celebrating its centennial this year. And in the prairie style, he built it always around a big central hearth, and he opened up all the rooms. He called them boxes within boxes from Victorian houses, so that you have a big space like this, so that the family could see one another. And he often used a cruciform style, which is what my house is. So you've got two matching rooms here, and a big atrium room with a big hearth. And the whole idea was so that the family could be together. You could always see each other across the house, and it'd be great togetherness. You could sit by the hearth, you know, this pre-video game, by the way, and you could, you know, you could read poetry to each other, etc. Unfortunately, in 1909 when he built the house. That was the very year that he deserted his family with his six children, left them with a huge grocery bill, and ran off to Europe with the wife of his client, Mamo Borthwick Cheney. As you probably know also, she was murdered along with her two children and four other people by a maniac at Taliesin, which was then burned to the ground. But that's just the beginning of the story. He got a lot of sympathy letters. This was huge news. Everything, by the way, if you read this book, you know nothing about Frank Lloyd Wright. This will give you an overview of his career, what he did, his houses, and also will be fairly accurate in terms of his life. Within 6 months of that, he met his second wife, Miriam, and they were conjugal within 6 months. He was very resilient, and he also needed to have a woman around. He was a mama's boy, of course, but we won't get into that. And Miriam became my favorite character of this novel, and I'm going to introduce her to you tonight. She had certain problems, as you will see. And she couldn't marry Frank, nor could Mema, because the first wife, Kitty, would not give him a divorce. And what wound up happening is he was sort of a pariah then and went into exile. That's when he went to Japan to build the Imperial Hotel, and Miriam went with him. After 9 years, Kitty granted a divorce. The hotel was built. Frank Lloyd Wright came back to Taliesin, which he had rebuilt, and established Miriam there. And finally, they were able to marry. They got married, and she, within 6 months, left him. It was boring in Wisconsin. She left him. And in the interval, that's when he found a much younger woman, 30 years younger, Olga Ivanovna, whom he wound up being married to for the next 31 years. In this chapter, Miriam has left. She's in California. And that's all I'll tell you. Okay. This chapter is called Miriam Agonistes. None of the doctors could help her in Los Angeles or the provincial outpost of San Diego either. Little people, all of them. Sniveling types, hand-wringers, an army of effete little bald-headed men in spectacles who are mortified of the law. As if this law had any more right to exist than prohibition, because who was the federal government to dictate what people could and couldn't do with their own bodies, their own minds, their personal needs and wants and compulsions? Were they going to regulate needs then? Dole them out? Tax them? Miriam was so furious, so burned up and blistered with the outrage of it, that she must have been overly severe with the cabman. The driver, with his hat cocked back on his head and his trace of a Valentino mustache, because when they got to the border at Tijuana, he stopped the car, turned round on the seat, and demanded payment in full, insolently, out of little insolent pig's eyes. "This is as far as I go," he said, and she couldn't place his accent. She was immovable. She felt her face concretize, the pores sealing up, the muscles round her mouth and eyes going to stone. "Nonsense. Drive on." There was a customs man standing off to the left of the car, a slouching congenital idiot with a lazy eye and bad teeth, and he'd already showed them his smile and waved them on. There were no searches here, no passports required. And he was giving her a curious look now, as if he'd seen everything in his day, every sort of indecision and cataclysm, women 4 and 5 months gone going down to La Clinica for a procedure that would make them right again. Rum runners with their empty trucks, day trippers and ethnologists and rock collectors, but this was a new wrinkle altogether. "No," he said, "no more." And he shoved his way out of the car and tried to pull open the back door, but she held fast to the handle. "Get out," he insisted, and it gave her a small pulse of pleasure to hear the tremor in his voice. The war was already won. "I won't," she said, just to savor the words on her lips. "Now, I paid you to take me to Tijuana, and I won't budge until you fulfill your end of the bargain." She looked round her in growing outrage. The customs man, a river of Mexicans in pajamas and serapes, mules, dogs, Indian eyes, Indian hair, dust, muck, filth, the street vendors and beggars in their cutaway rags, and hanging over it all, the heat, the impossible, punishing heat that stewed the odor of decay till she could barely breathe. "Move on," she demanded. He saw the look in her eyes, saw the way her face had set, and he didn't even try to jew her out of an extra 2 bits as any of the rest of them would. He just shrugged, climbed back into the cab, and put the car in gear. A moment later, they were lurching down the rutted streets, the human circus of Mexican poverty unfolding outside the window like a mural in a moving picture. She was uncomfortable, feeling the heat, dizzy from the stench. She'd sweated through her undergarments, and the seat of her dress and her hair was gummy beneath the parrot-green silk caftan, which she'd chosen expressly to bring out the color of her eyes. But there was no one here to care about the color of her eyes, just peasants, campesinos, isn't that what they called them? And what was pharmacy? A cognate, farmacia, wasn't it? She consulted the Spanish-English phrasebook in her purse and found the term under the heading of useful phrases. ¿Dónde está la farmacia? There was a dog dead beside the road, the carcass swollen beneath a second skin of insects, people strolling by as if it were some sort of monument, as if it had been molded of brass and put there by the town council to honor canine achievement. The cab lurched again, in and out of a rut, and the dog was gone. The farmacia, she said, the cords tightening in her throat. Take me to the farmacia, the first one you see, quickly, quickly. He didn't seem to have heard her, so she repeated herself. A scorched minute blistered by. There were birds now, some sort of Mexican birds, exploding up from the road. Pigeons, Mexican pigeons. The farmacia, she said. And she was beginning to feel desperate. All her outrage evaporated in the face of the hopelessness of this place, these peasants, this driver. And he was an American, of some sort. A legitimate cabbie from San Diego who'd agreed on a legitimate price here and back, half paid in advance, half when she was restored to her hotel on Coronado Island, where the sea breezes stirred themselves each afternoon to neutralize the heat. Peasants she knew. Peasants she dealt with in Paris, where they were alternately surly and unctuous, and Tokyo, where they bowed to the floor and laughed behind your back. But these people frightened her. It was dangerous here. She could see that. See it with her own eyes. Prostitutes, drunks, that man there, staggering as if he were riding an invisible donkey, his eyes red as some demon's, staring belligerently through the window at her. And there, another one, unconscious in the dirt and no more concerned than the dog in his jacket of flies. She was about to open her mouth again, about to say she'd had enough, forget it, he could take her back and away from all this chaos and filth and the ungodly stink, when the car abruptly came to a halt. What, she said, what is it? But the driver, was he Italian, was that it? Merely pointed a finger. It took her a moment, and then she saw the sign, black script, freehand on a white background, Farmacia. She gathered up her purse and the cloth bag she'd brought along, leaned over the front seat, and commanded her voice long enough to say, "You wait now," and then she was out on the street, and the sun hit her like an axe. 5 steps, a wooden walk, and then the door and the bell that announced her, even as the cab jumped into gear and shot away from the curb with a crunch of tires and a rat-tat-tat of exhaust. She felt the fear seize her then, a cold hand laid on the back of her neck. She was going to die here, she was sure of it, lost and abandoned in a place where her French was no use to her, or her southern charm either, and her children would never know. Her friends, Frank, no obsequies, no sepulchre, nothing. She'd be like that dog lying bloated at the side of the road. At that moment, as the bell sounded and the door swung back, and she stood there frozen while the taxi receded down the street, 2 women in mantillas came up the walk behind her, their black hair braided and their eyes ducking away from hers. And what did they want? They wanted to go through the door, that was it. And she was in their way, and they were waiting for her, politely, respectfully. She came to her senses then, murmured an apology, illogically in French, pardon, and stepped into the store. It was close inside, and dark, hotter even, if that was possible, than the street outside. Slowly, as her eyes began to adjust, the features of the place seemed to take on shape. There were jars everywhere, a cornucopia of jars, and in the jars various dried herbs and potions, and there were folded browning sheaves of plants suspended from the ceiling to dry, the smell of them musty and bitter and sweet all at once. And the counter. The counter behind which stood a man identical to the spineless physicians and pharmacists of Los Angeles and San Diego counties, right down to the spectacles and the bald dome of his head, except that his skin was the color of the varnish on a very old chest of drawers. And what was that in the jar at his elbow? Chicken's feet? She thought of the apothecary shop in Romeo and Juliet, the mad mixer of potions. And what was the word she wanted, the word she'd practiced all the way down here in the cab? Un dormidero, that was it, un dormidero. But then the man behind the counter smiled at her, a broad, winning, helpful, and welcoming smile. Anything can be purchased here, senora, anything at all, that was what his smile said. And the word flew right out of her head. He said something then, something she didn't catch and couldn't be expected to, but the gist of it was obvious. How may I help you? feeling better now, feeling herself again, or nearly herself. She straightened up and approached the counter, giving him his smile back even as the two women who'd followed her in browsed among the jars and their mysterious contents. What she said then was contained in a single word, a word she hadn't had to memorize. Morfina. She watched his eyes. Do you understand? His smile widened. He nodded. I want, she said carefully, morfina. She didn't wait till she was back at the hotel, though certainly that would have been more pleasant, because she'd been feeling ill and run down and lightheaded all morning. And her stomach was cramping, and her bowels weren't right, and no amount of bicarbonate of soda could even begin to help. The man behind the counter, the little brown pharmacist who'd suddenly become her best friend in the world, had given her what she wanted, all she wanted. The only limiting factor, the number of dollars she laid out on the tin countertop. Dollars outweighing pesos here. And that was funny, since dollar was some sort of nonsense word as far as she knew, and peso was a measure of weight, of gravity itself. And she'd filled her cloth bag with a dozen tubes of morphine sulfate hypodermic tablets and 10 of the diamorphine hydrochloride. And she got herself some new pravas as well, the needle she carried in her very clever little kit. It was made to resemble an outsized cigarette lighter, with room for 2 tubes and the hypodermic itself, having become blunted through use and unpleasant in the extreme. When the purchase was completed, the two women in shawls watching her surreptitiously and the pharmacist smiling till she thought his head would burst, she gave him another word, which might have been Spanish, or maybe it was Latin. Taxi? Taxi, he repeated, as if she'd just supplied the one term that would make his life complete. Taxi, see, and he shouted something toward a tumbled nest of straw baskets where a striped Mexican blanket concealed the doorway behind the counter. In the next moment, a boy with his eyes still asleep emerged, took one look at her, and ran out into the street, shouting the magic word. The driver knew not a syllable of English, but San Diego was not an Anglican designation, and the dollars she waved at him immediately bridged any difficulties of interpretation. The sun hammered her briefly, and then she was in the back of the car, everyone grinning now, the pharmacist and the two customers who'd followed her out into the street, the boy and the taxi driver and even the random passers-by. A whole world of dedicated grinning. The door shut on her. The car, a tin Lizzie, a flivver, a rat trap of the worst and flimsiest construction, and ancient, the first sedan ever made. But it had a roof and, apparently, an engine. The thing jolted and bumped as if it were pitching headlong down the side of a cliff. The smells assaulted her all over again. The heat crouched atop her right under the caftan, and she wouldn't take it off, wouldn't show her hair and the sweat and the fright she must have been. But none of that mattered for long, because immediately she was dissolving a tablet in water and drawing it into her crevasse, and between bumps finding a vein high up on her right thigh beneath the rolled-up, sweat-soaked hem of her dress. After that, the breezes blew and the smells dissipated. The man at the border waved them on without a second glance. The world took on a metallic sheen, the sheen of the high seas as seen from a deck chair on the SS Paris. And she wasn't in Mexico anymore. She wasn't in the bleached brown desert of San Diego either, not on land at all. She was on a cruise, perched high up on the rail with the wind in her face and the birds wheeling overhead on her way back to France. So, I think that will do for the reading, but I'll tell you a little bit more. Miriam was a morphine addict, and it seems fairly outrageous. But in her day in Paris, it wasn't understood quite what the dangers of morphine were. And I liken it to, let's say, casual cocaine use in the 80s. And before she knew it, she was addicted. She was also quite mentally unstable and extremely demanding. And in my telling here, this is a kind of a complex telling, we're telling the story of these women in reverse, so that you're meeting Miriam here when she's already on the outs with Frank. And throughout this first section, she will be hounding him over his relationship with Olga Vanna, who he already has gotten pregnant. And, of course, Miriam, when they met, was already 45 and had had children by her previous husband, and they couldn't have children together. And by the way, I called my wife. Our children are grown. We're going to have non-uplets next week. We're going to start implanting them. Yeah. At any rate, Frank Lloyd Wright, he married, as I said, his childhood sweetheart, Kitty, had 6 children, left her behind, ran off with Mema. Each of his women seemed more and more challenging and more exotic and sophisticated. Despite what Frank says in his autobiography, he really only had 2 semesters of college and was very indifferent at that. Mema, though, unlike Kitty, who was also uneducated beyond high school, was college educated and very much a feminist and a free thinker and very dynamic. Miriam, when she first came to him, and we'll give you this scene later on in the book, because once you see her as a harpy, then we go back in time when you see her in all her attractiveness. As I said, 6 months after the death of Mema, he received a sympathy letter from this stranger, and she came to visit him at his studio in Chicago, and she was stunning. She was then 45, beautifully turned out, and with her Parisian manners and style, and she was wearing a sealskin cape at that time, and, you know, glorious big hats and all sorts of, she loved hanging beads and all of this stuff, and she swept in and amazed him. And the actual conversation that he quotes in the autobiography is, after, you know, an hour or so of just chattering on about poetry and romance and so on, she said, "Well, how do you like me?" And he said, "I've never seen anything like you." And a week later, on Christmas Eve, they were lovers, and he moved her into Taliesin as soon as he got it rebuilt. The obvious metaphor here for me is why I'm writing a book like this is, of course, writing a novel, building a novel, is sort of like building a house. We both, Frank Lloyd Wright and I, would have a dream of something. He always drew first a picture of what it would be as an artist with the colored pencils. So I would see something, and I would begin my building, too. He would then go to plans, but he was famously improvisatory. That's why there were so many cost overruns. I don't have a plan beforehand, but a structure suggests itself to me, and that becomes the overriding plan until I'm putting the last bricks in and so on and so on. And so I do feel an identity with him. The other two great egomaniacs I wrote about were both men of science, and I can appreciate that. But here I'm trying to understand a little better this artist. Where we part ways, though, is that he seemed to love tumult in his life. He had to be, in the tabloid headlines, he had to be pursued by debt collectors and the sheriff and outraged clients and the whole works just to be able to work. He needed to have his back up against the wall. His family motto is truth against the world. That is, he is always, you know, the genius who is misunderstood. And by the way, our family motto, and if someone could get me the Latin, I'd appreciate it, is we are always in a hurry. But I cannot work under such conditions. For me, in order to get into my unconscious dream, which you will have to get into on your side when you read it, I have to have absolute serenity. And yes, you know, we had little children, but we put them on leashes out with the door. No. They had a mother at home, and they knew that, you know, there was loud music in that room, and their father was doing something mysterious in there, and they respected that. So, now, I would like to take some of your questions.
I actually have 2 questions. One is, if you could talk a little bit about what it's like to live in a Wright house. Do you have to have Wright furniture? And I saw a documentary on people who had a lot of complaints about people looking in their windows and some of the furniture being uncomfortable and stuff like that. And I'm wondering what your feeling is about the house. Obviously, you have enough peace and serenity to write. And my other question is if you could talk a little bit about the Japanese narrator and why he's there, because I'm okay. 120 pages into it, and I'm not sure you need him.
Oh, wow. Uh-oh. Okay, will you excuse me? I got to go call my mother. Okay, to answer the first question, Frau Boyle is the genius in this. She is, you know, a nut of collecting antiques, and she has exquisite taste, and she did it and designed the whole house and everything else. He made no furniture for this house. He was not present on the job site. He had run off to Europe with Mema at that time. And so she has period antiques. You know, it's craftsman era, and Stickley, you know, reproductions. And I have a friend who is the best read person I know. He lives on a ranch near Avila Beach up by San Luis Obispo. And you have to go through all these cattle gates and whatnot to get there. There's no electricity. It's black, dark all the time. And he's a woodworker. And he makes furniture. And he made a lot of furniture for the house for us. He's the best read person because while working, he's listening to books on tape all day long. And incidentally, he's the greatest host in the world. He gave a party for about 15 of us a few years ago. And, you know, we slept in our cars, of course. But he dug a new latrine for us. What a man. And what is it like to live there? It's pretty illuminating. I would never get tired of it. As far as keeping people out, of course, we have the concertina wire and the killer dogs and so on. People respect it. There's a locked gate, and they come to the gate, and they can photograph. What most people don't realize is they're only seeing the north side of the house. It is meant to face east, but the second owner, we're the fourth owner, Mrs. Blickenstaff, broke the property up for her children so that the only way in is from the south and north, and no one sees the front unless they come by special invitation. Now, let's address the second question. If I were you, I would reserve judgment until I finish the book. And let me explain my thinking here and what I'm doing with this. As this woman has pointed out, the book is presented in this way. I'm getting it both ways. I didn't want to repeat what I'd done with Kinsey and simply have an acolyte tell the story. But it begins in this way. And there are the three major sections are about Miriam, who you just heard about. That begins Miriam. Then about Mema, Olgavana first, then Miriam, then Mema finally. So I could end with the tragedy. So it goes backwards in time. And also, you know, you begin with the relationship being sunny and wonderful, and you see it getting really dark. However, I didn't write it. I didn't write this book. It was co-written by my narrator, Tadashi Sato, who is an invented character who was an apprentice during the 30s. His story goes forward. He gives three long introductions, and you will see his entire story go forward so that you learn all about Frank Lloyd Wright and see him from Tadashi's eyes, the master, Raito-san, he calls him, during the period of the 30s and 40s. So you get a whole sweep of that, whereas the women's story ends around the time of the marriage to Olgavana and the birth of Iovanna, the daughter. However, Tadashi is not the sole writer of this, and there are footnotes. And the footnotes not only inform you, but they can be quite hilarious because we don't know how much English Tadashi knows. I presume that he gave a memoir to his grandson-in-law, O'Flaherty-san, the Irish-American unpublished novelist who has novelized this for him. So Tadashi is reading this and introducing it, and then he gives little footnotes because he's perplexed by what O'Flaherty-san has done. So I'm having a lot of there's a lot of playfulness here in a Nabokovian kind of way or a Borgesian kind of way, and I love doing it. And also, though, you will be informed about Frank Lloyd Wright and his work as well. It just, again, just going with it, what comes natural. And I'll bet you like it. Okay. Yes.
How much time did they give you at Taliesin? Were you able to spend the night there?
How much time did they give me at Taliesin? Was I able to spend the night there? The first time I came just as a tourist, I didn't know what I was going to do. But they knew I was coming because the only time I could go was in March. By the way, I delivered this book in July of 07. We held it. You've probably heard of this town. The others hadn't heard. There was an election or something last fall. So we avoided that, and we also got the centennial of the house. So it's a while ago. So it would have been March of 06. I went to Taliesin, but it's not open then. So we paid a good deal of money, and they allowed us to have a special tour, but there's no furnishings. It's all covered, and it's very, very cold. In fact, I'm a California guy now, I'm sorry, but I do rely on my body fat to keep me warm in emergencies. I was dressed in full long johns, a jeans, sweatshirt, sweater, the hooded sweatshirt, the hat, the whole thing, and I just about froze to death in Wisconsin because it was only like 15 degrees, but I forgot about the 10,000 mile per hour wind. That's what got me. Anyway, we did the tour, and it's very moving, and it's great. And, you know, you take your shoes off on the rug, and you walk through, and they tell you everything you want to know. Then when the book was finished, so this would be fall of 07, my wife and I went back. I wanted to see the floor plan again, make sure I got everything right. And we did the same thing. And we took our shoes off and so on. But then it had been prearranged. In came all the people from the foundation who were very helpful to me. And we put our shoes back on and we had a party and drank wine by God and started a fire. And then, even though we didn't burn it down, even though we didn't really want to, they made us sleep in the bed, in the very bed. And it was a great experience. It was, first of all, freezing cold. And we were alone in the house, which was very mystical and magical. And the ghosts beat at the walls and howled all night long. The best part, though, was in the morning to get up and be able to walk the grounds without any interference from anybody and feel that you're welcome. So, yeah, they were very generous and kind to me.
Why did you say you didn't want to?
Why did I say I didn't want to? Because it's a little embarrassing, you know. It's better in the hotel, the motel down the street where we'd stayed before. But it turned out to be great. Okay, so thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.